Good morning. Michael Bloomberg is betting on Super Tuesday. Long before he spent on campaign ads, he spent on philanthropy, including money in Charlotte, North Carolina, how that led to an endorsement. On Morning Edition from NPR News. The president insists a coronavirus outbreak is not inevitable. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Federal health officials have said otherwise and told the country to prepare. At this point, what is the risk to the American people? To predict where the coronavirus will go, scientists are using a blood test to find out where it has been. And this hour, what does a veteran think about the proposed peace deal with the Taliban? It is Thursday, February 27th. Rosanda Thomas, better known as Chili from TLC, turns 49 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Milwaukee police say they've gone through more than 20 buildings at the Molson Coors Brewing Company facility after a suspect shot and killed five people on Wednesday. Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales says the suspect is also dead.
The suspect, a 51-year-old Milwaukee man, who was found deceased inside one of the buildings. The suspect was an employee of Molson Coors and died from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound.
The names of those who were killed have not been released, nor has the name of the suspect. The Molson Coors complex in Milwaukee is large. About 1,000 people work there. President Trump has tapped Vice President Mike Pence to oversee the U.S. government's response to COVID-19. That's the disease caused by the new coronavirus. NPR's Nurit Eisenman says Trump made the announcement Wednesday in a news conference.
More than 78,000 people have been infected in China, where the virus first emerged. And while only 60 cases have reached the United States, health officials now say it's a matter of when, not if, infections will start rising in the U.S. At the press conference, Trump expressed confidence that the U.S. would be, quote, very, very ready. And he noted that his administration has requested $2.5 billion from Congress to ramp up preparedness. But Trump was vague on how much was really needed, adding that Republicans on the Hill are suggesting $4 billion should be allocated, while some Democrats have proposed $8.5 billion. Then Trump said, whatever they want to give, he'll take it. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon and the South Korean government say they're going to postpone their annual military exercises. There's concern over the coronavirus outbreak. Nearly 1,800 cases of the illness have been diagnosed in South Korea. That includes one American military service member. Authorities in India's capital, New Delhi, are accused of failing to stop violence there against Muslims. Rioting mobs have killed at least 34 people in recent days. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports most of them are Muslims.
Delhi police are accused of beating up human rights lawyers, destroying CCTV cameras, and standing by as Hindu mobs torched Muslim homes. Delhi police fall under India's Home Ministry, which is led by a Hindu nationalist who's been accused of inciting violence against Muslims himself in his speeches and on Twitter. After 3 days of violence, police are now patrolling streets in riot gear, telling residents not to fear and shops to reopen.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. Clashes broke out in Greece on Wednesday between police and residents of two Greek islands. Greek authorities have said they want to build new camps there to house migrants. Hundreds of island residents attacked officers who were guarding the future camp sites. Dozens of police officers have been injured. This is NPR. A federal appeals court has ruled the Trump administration can withhold millions of dollars in law enforcement grants to force states to cooperate with federal immigration officers. New York and six other states had sued the federal government, but the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled the U.S. Attorney General has the right to impose conditions on states and local governments that receive federal money. An appeal is expected. Former Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh will be sentenced this morning on four federal convictions. From member station WYPR, Emily Sullivan reports Pugh resigned last spring in the midst of a corruption scandal.
It all started last March when the Baltimore Sun reported that Pugh sold $500,000 worth of her self-published children's books to the University of Maryland Medical System, on whose board she served. Prosecutors say the Democrat racked up more than $850,000 by selling the sloppily made books, many of which were double sold or never printed to begin with. They say she used the proceeds to unlawfully enrich herself, buy a second house, and illegally fund her campaign for mayor. Prosecutors have recommended a 5-year sentence. Pugh's lawyers have asked for 1 year and 1 day instead. For NPR News, I'm Emily Sullivan in Baltimore.
The National Weather Service says a powerful winter storm is coalescing near the eastern Great Lakes. It will slide into southern Canada and then move east into New York and New England. The Weather Service warns that extremely heavy snow will fall in areas near Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. It will last through Saturday morning. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Neon, presenting Portrait of a Lady on Fire, a love story set in 18th century France about an affair between an artist and her female subject, now playing in select theaters, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. We do not know how the 2020 election is going to end, but voters in 8 American communities will give us clues. NPR is asking where voters are, where they are on the issues and on the candidates, or just where they are, because your community can really affect how you see the world, right? This election year, NPR News teams will visit and revisit Dallas-Fort Worth, Pensacola, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Southwest Washington State. I'm part of a team that's going to Orange County, California. We began the project yesterday in Pueblo, Colorado, and in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this morning we have the story of a presidential candidate with some history in Charlotte.
Michael Bloomberg has been involved here since long before he declared. That work helped him to receive a big endorsement from Charlotte's mayor, which seems good for him, but it became surprisingly controversial, as we will discuss with Steve Harrison of Charlotte member station WFAE. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
What was Bloomberg's involvement in Charlotte?
Philanthropy. He's donated billions across the country on issues like gun control and climate change. Mm. That gives him influence over issues he cares about. It also gives him political connections now that he's running.
What do you mean?
So in 2018, his foundation made a $2.5 million donation to Charlotte to help the city reduce its carbon footprint. That brought him into contact with Charlotte's Democratic Mayor Vi Lyles. She was elected in 2017 and is very popular with both Democrats and Republicans. She was one of the biggest supporters of bringing the Republican National Convention to Charlotte.
Hmm.
And Bloomberg came here for a press conference, and the mayor introduced him. Let's listen.
And with all great endeavors, with all great plans, it's nice to have influential friends. I want to introduce to you from Bloomberg Philanthropies and the Bloomberg American Cities Climate Challenge, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
All right, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I have a special affinity to Charlotte. My mother's name was Charlotte. Anyways, we're here to talk about an urgent challenge facing Charlotte and the whole world, and that is climate change.
Okay, so the mayor made this grant to Charlotte. What happened then?
So that was 2018. Then less than a year later, Bloomberg declares he's running for president. He, of course, skipped the early states and will be on the ballot for the first time on Super Tuesday, which includes North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And he opened his very first field office of his entire campaign right here in Charlotte. And Mayor Lyles endorsed him for president earlier this month. That's a pretty big deal. Democrats see her as a rising figure. Charlotte's the biggest city in the state, and she's also African-American, and the black vote is critical in a Democratic primary here.
Doesn't Bloomberg need some help with African-American voters?
He does, I mean, especially among younger black voters, and that's primarily because of the mayor's stop-and-frisk policies in New York City. And Mayor Lyles has faced immediate blowback, even from her own daughter.
Hmm.
Her daughter wrote on Twitter right after that endorsement, quote, "I have no words to describe how devastatingly disappointed I am in every Democratic mayor who has endorsed Michael Bloomberg, particularly the black ones and especially the ones closest to me."
Ow. Now, we followed up with Mayor Lyles' daughter, and she said her mom is understanding, told her to speak her mind, but this is an obvious political problem. So let's follow up with NPR's Sarah McCammon, who's been talking with voters all over Charlotte. And Sarah, what are you hearing?
Well, I'm also hearing a lot of concern, and not just from the younger black activists. I talked to a couple of black activists in their early 60s, Willie Fleming and Corinne Mack. She's with the local NAACP.
I think one of the things, too, that bothers me that he had his first debate, and he get endorsed before he has his first debate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand that.
Unless somebody pays you to support them.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I mean, how are we going to endorse people because they paid to be endorsed? What's up with that?
And I heard this a few times, the suspicion that maybe the endorsement was tied to Bloomberg's wealth and that $2.5 million donation to Charlotte.
Naturally, we wanted to ask the mayor about this. We'd already been asking for a broad interview about Charlotte as we start this special series on the city. But day after day, her staff was unable to set it up. A spokesman said that she had a very busy schedule and then said we had to go through a different spokesperson whose name and number we never received. We asked a person linked with the Bloomberg campaign to connect us to this mayor who'd endorsed him, but the Bloomberg campaign declined to help. It seemed really unusual. So I went and introduced myself to Mayor Lyles at a city council meeting this week, and she was very open face-to-face. She's an NPR listener.
Mayor Lyles.
Hi.
Hi, Steve Inskeep
hey,
with
Steve.
NPR.
It's just, so nice to see you.
Good. I'm glad to be here. Just want to introduce myself.
You sound just like you do on radio.
Oh, well, thank
oh my
you
God,
very
that
much.
Is so cool.
She agreed to an interview later that evening, but then a staff member called to cancel. We should mention the invitation remains open, and her spokesman insists she's just had a busy schedule.
And as someone who covers the city on a day-to-day basis, I'll say this is pretty unusual. I mean, the mayor is really very open, and I think this kind of shows how hard this endorsement has been.
Does Bloomberg have some appeal in Charlotte?
He does. I've been interviewing voters in the more prosperous part of the city, and there is some interest, including from a retired pharmacist, Swati Patek.
I don't think it's the TV ads that have swayed me. I think it's his accomplishments while he was mayor. I feel like he's a businessman, he's successful, and he ran a large economy in New York. And I think, what else do you want someone to prove just because they've not? He's been in government, he's been private business, so.
Okay, so Bloomberg has some support, but another prominent Charlotte politician has made a different choice than the mayor, and we were able to interview him. Braxton Winston is his name. He became famous locally when he protested a police shooting in 2016. He's now been elected to the city council, and he has endorsed Bernie Sanders.
We are trying to change things. We're not trying to just tweak the system that is built to leave people out. We're here to create a system that works for all people. Unfortunately, that's seen as revolutionary at this day and time.
Can Sanders win in November?
Yes.
Will Sanders win in November if he's nominated?
Yes.
You feel sure of it?
Yes.
You don't feel it's a risk?
We have organizers. We have organizers, and people are going to organize and organize and organize.
There is more than a little irony here, because Braxton Winston, the Sanders supporter, says he once benefited from the philanthropy of Michael Bloomberg. He got a grant to go to an elite prep school, which changed his life in many ways. But you do see here a divide in the Democratic Party. We should mention Mayor Mike Bloomberg visits this city on Saturday, and we'll get a chance to see his support in Charlotte. On Monday, another candidate is in town. President Trump campaigns in Charlotte right before the voting on Super Tuesday. We've been reporting on Charlotte, North Carolina, as we go where voters are. We've been talking with Sarah McCammon of NPR News and Steve Harrison of WFAE. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
We're covering the election as well as another big story, the coronavirus. As it spreads more widely around the globe, scientists are starting to use this powerful new tool. Researchers in Asia are using a blood test that identifies people who've previously been exposed to the virus. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, this is helping them figure out how to respond to COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus.
The current lab test for the coronavirus used in the United States identifies people who are currently spreading the virus, and that's crucial information. But that test doesn't reveal who had previously been infected. That's important, too, for understanding the unfolding epidemic. Lauren Ansel Myers at the University of Texas at Austin says these tests look for antibodies, which the body produces a week or two after someone has been infected.
They can identify people who have been infected but never identified as infected, either because they never developed symptoms or they had symptoms that were never correctly diagnosed.
That means the test can identify silent infections in addition to people who have recovered. If it turns out a ton of people got infected but didn't get sick, that means the virus is less fatal than it now appears. And Meyer says that's just one insight the test will bring.
One of the key questions that we're grappling with is what's happening with children in this outbreak.
Very few have ended up in the hospital. Is that because they're not getting infected, or they're getting infected but not getting sick? An answer to that question will help public health officials figure out whether it makes sense to close schools if there's a big outbreak.
Without knowing whether children are getting infected or the rate at which they're getting infected or how severe the disease is in children, it's really hard for us to project what the impacts of school closures might be.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is currently developing an antibody test, but they're now playing catch-up with scientists in both Singapore and China. Dr. Stanley Perlman is a coronavirus researcher at the University of Iowa.
I think that the Chinese laboratories have been amazingly fast. I think they already have some tests that they're using. I haven't seen any publications to show that they're validated. And of course, that's what you want to know. But I think they're really capable of doing this pretty quickly.
Validating the test is critical. Otherwise, you have no idea how many false findings you're getting. You don't want to flag people who have been infected with one of the harmless coronaviruses that are already in wide circulation. Assuming the Chinese test is reliable, scientists there can figure out if these antibodies provide good protection against the disease and how long they persist. People who have been exposed to the virus might only be immune for a matter of months, Perlman says.
So you could imagine if the virus is around in a year and the antibody has waned, that maybe someone could be reinfected. Again, this is speculative. We don't know.
That could mean repeated waves of the disease rather than doing most of its damage in one particularly bad year. Because it takes the body some time to produce these antibodies, this test is not useful for tracking the illness in real time, so it won't replace the diagnostic test the CDC is currently running. But to understand where the epidemic is going, we need to know where it's been, says Andrew Pekosh at Johns Hopkins University.
Has this virus ever entered the population undetected and been spreading? Again, if it's a mild disease that's induced by this, it may not have registered the large enough number of cases to get on the public health radar screen.
That was the case for Ebola and HIV. Those viruses circulated in humans for many years before scientists recognized the diseases they cause. Scientists discovered this by running an antibody test on blood that had been stored long ago. Pekosh says by Skype that this test can answer so many questions, demand for it will be fierce.
So you have to also think about scale of production and making sure that the test that you're doing can be scaled up for widespread use.
Since the federal government has declared a health emergency, approval will speed through the Food and Drug Administration. But first, they need a product they can evaluate. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And this is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Trump's deep state hit list. That's the headline of an article by our guest Jonathan Swan, national political reporter at Axios. He explains how the Trump White House and its allies assembled lists of disloyal government officials to oust and lists of loyalists to replace them. The lists explain some recent personnel changes. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Emma. Jane Austen's romantic comedy about love and all its surprises is reimagined in the new movie Emma, directed by Autumn DeWilde. Now playing in select theaters everywhere March 6th. From Mindbody, where wellness and people meet. With thousands of fitness classes to find and book in one place. Studios can list their business at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. And from ADP, from sharing culture through food to making flights feel elegant, ADP is focused on helping people achieve what they're working for. HR, talent, time, benefits, and payroll. Informed by data and designed for people.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. The United States is on the verge of a peace deal with the Taliban. If it's signed this weekend, and if it holds, American troops will gradually leave Afghanistan after more than 18 years of conflict. We wanted to see how this looks to a veteran of America's longest war. I first talked to Kristen Rouse back in 2009. That was after her first tour in Afghanistan. She'd go on to serve two more tours. Since then, she's become an advocate for veterans. We connected yesterday, and first she told me what surprised her the most about the Afghan troops she fought alongside.
The welcome that I received was just amazing. You know, there were definitely differences in how I was treated because I was a woman, but it was really interesting because these gentlemen would share things with me about their families that they wouldn't share with men.
Like what?
I remember, you know, like some of the gentlemen would show me a photo, like on their phone, of their wife, and you know, and some of them on occasion would say, "Well, my wife wishes you hello, says hello
really?
To you." And then I would be able to ask them and talk with them about their wives, about their daughters.
Did you ever ask the Afghans that you worked with and befriended, like, what do you want for your country?
I think we talked about that from a family perspective.
Like, oh, tell me about that.
You know, I remember talking with an officer who, you know, a leader who had served in the Northern Alliance, the militia that that the U.S. initially partnered with in 2001. That was the soldiers that were on horseback. Mm-hmm. You know, they were with the Northern Alliance. You know, and he told me terrible stories of, like, you know, 15 days of continuous fighting, and he described to me that he never even took his boots off once because they were always engaged in this horrific fighting. And you know, but telling me that the one good thing that happened was that his family stayed safe. Hmm. Because so many didn't. But he told me that even where his family lived at the time, you know, he was putting his daughters in school as well as his sons. He insisted that his daughters go to school as well as his sons because he believed in their future. That answers the question of, what are you fighting for?
Yeah.
What was he doing it for? That was clear to me when he told me about his family.
You spent a lot of time with people who had spent much of their lives fighting or in a state of war.
Yeah.
We're now on the verge of a peace deal between the United States and the Taliban. When you think of that peace deal going into effect, what goes through your head?
I'm rooting for the Afghans. I want the people who I've interacted with in any way, I'm wishing for them to have a better deal, for them to have a better shot at life. You know, I wish for all of the children who are going to school to be able to realize their dreams in the same way that I was able to. You know, when I was working with the Afghan military, our mission was to work shoulder to shoulder, Shona by Shona, with our Afghan partners in support of, you know, strengthening and sustaining the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and do what it needs to do for the people, for the populace that it's accountable to. And so my concern with the negotiations that have happened is that the negotiations with the Taliban have not yet involved the Afghan government. Why have the negotiations not been shoulder to shoulder?
I want to ask you about an argument that some American lawmakers make, that President Trump makes, and that many of us as American citizens make when we sort of talk to each other as we go about our daily business. And the argument is that, you know, the United States has served as the world's police force for too long, and we need to get out of Afghanistan because we don't belong there after 19 years, and also because it is time for the Afghan people to take control of their own destiny. What do you think about that argument?
To be involved in a bloody conflict for 19 years it should stun us. We should be shocked daily and aware daily that Americans are going halfway across the planet and risking their lives, in many cases losing their lives, losing limbs, experiencing injuries that affect them their entire lives. I went 3 times, and I feel like I lucked out.
Really?
I feel like I didn't spend that much time. I mean, there's troops who've been lost in combat within the last year who've had 10 deployments. We're asking the same troops, the same families, to sacrifice over and over and over again, and for that to barely reach daily political consciousness, daily media consciousness, it's still stunning to me.
Do you feel like the 31 months that you spent in Afghanistan served a purpose?
You know, part of the story that I've told myself, that I have conversations with other, you know, with other veterans, with other families, is that, you know, I believe that all good faith efforts in the world amount to something. You know, the Afghan officer who I told you about, who fought with the Northern Alliance, who told me about putting his family through school, putting his daughters in school, he's not alive anymore.
What happened?
I don't know. But I know he's not alive anymore. I know he was at great risk. And it's heartbreaking. It breaks your heart over and over and over again.
How do you grieve for someone like that man, who you knew for a time, you knew deeply for a time, you admired, respected, worked with? You know he's passed, but you don't know why. How do you grieve for him?
I can tell a story.
Yeah.
You know, there's Afghans every day who choose hope. And so I choose hope along with them.
Kristen Rouse, U.S. Army veteran, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Noelle.
This is NPR News.
Generations of immigrants came to Pueblo, Colorado for jobs in Steel City. Today, a food pantry that once helped laid off steel workers serves a different clientele.
It's a middle class now that are hurting. Well, we've seen people from the police department, fire department, school teachers, nurses.
I'm Ari Shapiro in Pueblo for our new series, Where Voters Are, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says a new case of the coronavirus in California could be the first in the U.S. with no known connections to travel abroad or another known case.
But that means this could be the first instance in the United States of what officials call community spread. You know, in other words, they caught the virus in this country with no connection to any other country, that it could have spread here.
That's NPR's Rob Stein. The patient lives northeast of San Francisco and is being treated in Sacramento County. The CDC says the other 59 cases of the virus in the U.S. involved travel overseas or contact with those who'd been traveling out of the country. President Trump's 2020 campaign is suing the New York Times for libel. NPR's Windsor Johnston says the lawsuit stems from an essay on 2016 Russian election interference.
The lawsuit accuses the New York Times of falsely reporting that the Trump campaign had a, quote, overarching deal with Vladimir Putin's oligarchy to help in the campaign against Hillary Clinton. The suit also accuses the paper of publishing the article with the intentional purpose of harming the president's hopes for re-election this year. Trump has been locked in a long-running battle with the Times, accusing it repeatedly of bias.
Dow futures are down 225 points this morning following another down day on Wall Street. This is NPR News. Authorities in Wisconsin say they're still investigating a motive for yesterday's deadly shooting at a Molson Coors brewery complex in Milwaukee. Five employees were shot to death. Police say the gunman was a 51-year-old who also worked there. They say he later took his own life. More than 1,000 people work at that facility. Organizers of a planned supervised drug injection site in Philadelphia say they expect it to open next week. Michaela Winberg with member station WHYY says the facility is designed for opioid addicts.
More than 1,100 Philadelphians died in 2018 due to accidental drug overdoses. That's more than triple the number that died by homicide. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell is a board member at Safe House, and he's optimistic that a facility where people can use drugs under medical supervision will help make a difference.
The use of Safe House can save between 25 and 75 lives a year. I think it'll be more. Mm-hmm. But even if it saves 25 lives, it's worth it.
Safe injection sites already exist internationally, in countries like Canada and Australia. In the U.S., at least a dozen cities and states are exploring the possibility of opening them. For NPR News, I'm Michaela Winberg in Philadelphia.
Earlier this week, a federal judge rejected an effort by the Justice Department to prevent the site from opening. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines investment opportunities firsthand. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. And from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California. Well, President Trump has a new point person to lead the U.S. response to the coronavirus.
Mike is going to be in charge, and Mike will report back to me. But he's got a certain talent for this.
That would be the Vice President, Mike Pence. The president made this announcement last night during a government briefing on the virus. And during that briefing, President Trump contradicted his own health officials by saying he did not think an outbreak is inevitable.
Because of all we've done, the risk to the American people remains very low.
I want to bring in Dr. Tom Inglesby. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, joining us in our studios in Washington. Dr. Inglesby, thanks for taking the time for us.
Glad to be here.
Let me start with the president there, seeming to contradict, as I said, health officials in his own government saying it's not inevitable that this virus is going to spread in the United States. Sounds reassuring to all of us. Could he be right?
Well, I think the president also talked about how this disease, and so he compared this disease to seasonal influenza, which mm-hmm. happens to this country every year. And it's a good analogy in the sense that it's spreading like influenza spreads. And unfortunately, we see every year that seasonal flu or influenza spreads around the country and around the world. And I think it's most realistic for us to assume that this disease will also at some point be spreading in all countries around the world.
So is there a danger in over-reassuring Americans?
Yeah, I think it's important not to over-reassure. I think it's important to be really direct about what we know and what we don't know. And ultimately, I think the government will do better and the public will trust the government more if they understand exactly what's known about the disease and if they see that the government is looking ahead and trying to plan for what might come down the road.
Now, I know you're saying that this can be compared to the flu, which, you know, as you said, is hard to control the spread of. But, the president made a point that they've done what he views as a good job in stopping people bringing the virus into the country by traveling. Is there a chance that they have stopped this before, you know, things could get out of control?
I think they have identified travelers, and they've done that well, and they've isolated them and isolated their contacts. And that's been a good thing. But as we see in seasonal flu, people come into this country by a variety of means all over the country, from all over the world. And we saw other countries take the same measures like Italy and Iran as we did in terms of blocking travelers from China. And they now have very large outbreaks of their own. So I think our planning assumption should be that even with travel screening at our airports, that this disease will get into the country by other means.
Well, let me ask you now about some of the most recent news. Just as that press conference was ending last night, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed this new infection here in California, believing it might be the first person in the country to test positive without a known link to traveling abroad. Just tell me what the significance of that development might be.
If we find cases from travelers, we can isolate them and break the chain of transmission. We isolate them and make sure they don't infect others while they're sick. But if we find someone in the community who hasn't traveled and hasn't been around a known case, then that suggests that there is some kind of invisible line of transmission in that community which has gotten to that person. So it suggests that there are more cases in the community that haven't been identified. And in general, the way that that's termed around the world is community transmission or community spread. And that's worrisome if that turns out to be the case with this California case, because it does suggest that at least to some small extent, there is some transmission going on. But again, I haven't heard the full details, so I don't know if we can confirm that yet, but that would be a worrisome development.
When you think about whether our country is ready for widespread infections, or at least infections in terms of the numbers that other countries have seen, what do you look for in terms of what says to us we are ready or that we might have problems ahead?
I think our hospitals need to be really prepared for taking care of patients, especially ones who have critical illness or who might need time in the intensive care unit. We need the public to be informed about what it should be doing in terms of washing hands and covering their coughs and sneezes. So we need a good, effective communication campaign between the government and the public. And I think clarity from our top of health officials, from our top political leaders is going to be very important.
Dr. Tom Inglesby directs the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Much of the opera world has shunned Plácido Domingo since last year when allegations of sexual abuse became public. Now his home country of Spain has heard enough. From Barcelona, Lucia Benavides reports.
Patricia Wolf's career as a mezzo-soprano was just taking off in 1998 when she was offered the role of second lady in a performance of Mozart's The Magic Flute at the Washington National Opera. Plácido Domingo was artistic director. The opportunity meant she'd perform alongside the opera star, one of the most famous and celebrated tenor singers in the world. In an interview with the Associated Press last August, she says it was one of the happiest moments of her life.
And then imagine my surprise when I get to the second lady and then harassment starts. That kind of burst that bubble very quickly.
She says Domingo would stare at her breasts as he talked to her when she was in costume, or sometimes wait for her in the wings and ask if she really had to go home that night.
And you have to understand that when a man that powerful, he's almost like God in my business. He was. The first thing that goes through your mind is what?
Wolf is one of nine women who accused Domingo of sexual harassment, saying he pressured them to engage in sexual acts in order to advance their careers. The allegations spanned decades, during which Domingo held top managerial positions in various opera venues. After the accusations were made public, many arts organizations in the U.S. canceled Domingo's upcoming performances. But he continued to receive support from Spanish institutions.
Yo nunca. Nunca en mi vida he acosado a una mujer.
Never, never in my life, Domingo said, have I harassed a woman. That was in an interview last December with Spanish newspaper El País. But this Tuesday, when yet another accuser came forward, he released a statement taking full responsibility for his actions. A day later, Spain's Minister of Culture, José Manuel Rodríguez, announced cancellation of Domingo's performances in Madrid this May.
Desde el momento en que él ha reconocido los hechos y que ha querido asumir las responsabilidades.
In a press conference, Rodríguez said the ministry made the decision after Domingo recognized what he had done and assumed responsibility. Rodríguez added they're doing this in solidarity with the women affected. For NPR News, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
It's NPR News.
American Jesse Appel became a stand-up comic in China, now stuck in the U.S. because of COVID-19. He's making Chinese students in the U.S. laugh. Next time, here and now.
No matter where or when your day begins, start it with Morning Edition from NPR News, on demand, weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
Good morning, I'm David Green. Officials in Tennessee got a message from a concerned caller. Our national symbol was in distress. A bald eagle looked injured near a road in the town of Bulls Gap. The Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency says officers went to the scene and caught the eagle. It was fine, just full. Officials say too full to fly. Yeah, the bird gorged itself. It was in a food coma, something we can all relate to. The officers put it somewhere to digest in peace. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from Autism Speaks, their goal is to make 2020 the year of kindness for people with autism and their families through 1 million acts of kindness, big and small. More at AutismSpeaks.org/kindness.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green, and we want to take you right now to a comedy club in South Korea.
And I was like, you sure? 아닌 것 같은데, 아니, 형, 내가 틀린 적 있어?
That's the voice of comedian Danny Cho, switching between English and Korean. He was born and raised in the United States after his parents immigrated to Los Angeles from Korea. Danny's parents encouraged him to get a stable job. After college, he became a high-earning financial consultant here in California. But he gave all of that up to try and make a name for himself on the Korean comedy circuit. Our co-host Rachel Martin had a chance to talk to Danny about his first impressions of the comedy scene there.
The Western world, like, stand-up's been around for, you know, almost 100 years. Here, these guys just started. So think of a bunch of people that are trying stand-up for the first time. The audience, they don't know what the heck is going on. So it was just bad. The concept of punchlines and setups and all that other technique was just not fully translated.
So how do you walk into that scene? You want to be respectful of the people who are already there, trying to make the best of it that they can. But also you're like, dude, that is not funny. And I'm gonna show you what is.
So, you know, after the show, I kind of introduced myself and I was like, hey, guys, I've been doing stand-up for about 17 years now. And
you're like, I'm pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was kind of arrogant if I'm from their point of view, I guess. I was trying to explain to them, like, your setup was way too long and your punchline didn't even hit. Mm. So it's a 4-minute bit with no laughter. That's, you know, what is this, a podcast? That's what I told them, you know? I saw it. I said, you know what? Can I try to do stand-up? Give me a 15-minute set next week.
So here's Danny in this Beatles-themed bar in Seoul, a far cry from his college days at UCLA, where he'd do stand-up in between his classes in international economics.
Koreans got the biggest heads on earth. You know what I'm saying? Huge heads.
Danny graduated, he got a job in finance, he was earning six figures, but there was just something missing in his life. So he quit and became a full-time comic, something his parents didn't initially approve of. He made just $60 in his first month. 5 years passed. He always had this feeling that he was on the verge of a big break, but it never quite came. So eventually, Danny packed his bags and moved to Seoul. In an interview with the LA Times, he said he had to figure things all out again. A new culture he was tied to through his parents, and almost entirely new material. But he made it work.
The difficult part for me is that everything I think about, it starts off in English in my head, right? And so then I go, wait, so will this work for a Western audience or a Korean audience? That's always going to be the fight, right? And so, to be honest, I'd never know if it's going to work or not.
Do your parents think you're funny? Have they seen your stuff in Korean?
My parents, I don't think they ever found me funny. I think they find that it's ironic that a guy who they don't think is funny is making a living doing this in a country that they left, right. You know, they're like, why are you going back? They don't fully understand the move. I mean, personally, all I want to do is make sure that they don't worry. You know, every athlete, when they get their first big contract, what they do, they buy their mom a house, right? So that's kind of like what I want to do, right? So that's the move.
I'm sure she's listening. She's like, where's that new house?
Well, I'm glad this is all in English because she don't speak English. So.
Danny Cho, American stand-up, doing comedy in South Korea. Thanks so much, Danny. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
We're watching stocks slide again today.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines opportunities firsthand since 1937. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. To a large extent, the stock market has become a numerical expression of ebbing and flowing concern about the COVID-19 coronavirus. After a stock market rally on Wall Street fizzled and turned mixed yesterday, Hong Kong and Shanghai indexes are up modestly today, but Europe is down hard. The FTSE index in London is down more than 2%, the DAX in Germany down 2.2%. Here's Andrew Walker, the economics correspondent for our editorial partner, the BBC.
Financial markets are going through a reassessment of the likely economic impact of the new virus beyond China. There's been a surge in cases in Italy, followed by some draconian restrictions on movement in and out of towns in the north of the country at the centre of the outbreak. Reports of infections in other European countries have provoked concerns that there will be further constraints imposed on the movement of people and goods. Companies with travel-related businesses were especially hit. They have to contend with official restrictions and customers choosing not to travel. The airline EasyJet, for example, which operates largely in Europe, saw a further sharp fall in its share price today, bringing the total decline this week to well over 25%.
Andrew, thank you. Right now, Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures here are all down between 7 and 9/10%. The benchmark 10-year U.S. interest rate is at an all-time low, with money flowing into bonds. And on a bet that a slower world economy needs less oil, crude is down more than 2% in New York, $47.69 a barrel, the lowest since December 2018. Now, just looking through the long list of events canceled around the world because of concern about the virus, as collated by the business publication Quartz, Facebook's global marketing gathering in San Francisco was March 9th, but not anymore. The Milan Furniture Fair, the world's biggest, is postponing from April to June. The Dalai Lama is stopping ordination ceremonies and public events. Stormzy's tour through Asia is postponed. And there's news today every school in Japan will close from Monday through April 8th. Now to signs of economic dynamism in places sometimes the U.S. economy leaves behind. A new study from the Center for American Progress says some rural communities are seeing new energy, especially in what it calls graying America. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
Business is growing in rural graying America because there are more graying Americans. Benga Adjelore of the Center of American Progress led the study.
So a lot of it is population growth. And so areas that have a lot of population growth are going to see a lot more business dynamism.
The Census Bureau says almost a quarter of people 65 and older live in rural areas. Many are moving to rural places within reach of smaller cities, where they can still get what they need and for less. And though Florida is still a big place to retire, aging Americans are also moving to Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, states that have revamped their image to bring in new residents.
They have a lot of nice natural amenities, places that are kind of pretty.
In rural areas, retirement benefits can make up more than 50% of local spending. Megan Lawson with Headwaters Economics calls that the mailbox economy.
Non-labor income really can be a tremendous support, particularly in rural places that maybe don't have a robust job market.
And that retiree spending means more healthcare, retail, and construction jobs that in turn bring younger residents in. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Kronos, providing HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. Learn more about Kronos HR, payroll, talent, and time at kronos.com/HR swagger. And by Forex.com, helping traders find opportunity in currency trading for over 18 years. Forex.com, it's your world. Trade it. Forex trading involves significant risk of loss.
Now to Econ Extra Credit, where we revisit basic economics each week. A bunch of us are reading a free Econ 101 textbook, a chapter a week through April, from a project with the tagline, Teaching Economics Like the Last 20 Years Happened. This week, what economics tells us about all these hours we put in. Homa Zarghami is a professor of economics at Barnard College, who teaches from this book and advises this core econ project on curriculum. Welcome, Homa.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so the year was 1930. This legend among economists, Keynes, he makes this prediction, right, about how much time we're going to be working and how much time off we're going to have 100 years in the future. That's 2030. That is now 10 years from now. What does he predict?
He predicted that we would be working 15 hours a week. So we'd have a 4-day weekend and a 3-day work week, each day 5 hours.
You're working 15 hours a week, Homa?
I'm working 15 hours a day.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, we're still working a lot. So what fuels this? Why was Keynes wrong about the declining work week?
So some of the theories go back to another seminal economist, Thorsten Veblen, who had coined the term conspicuous consumption, where it's not only your absolute level of, say, consumption or income that matters to you, but your relative standing in society. And particularly if you have the people at the top of the income distribution making more money, that those consumption patterns of theirs are then going to trickle down to everybody else and set the new standard for consumption.
So this keeping up with the Joneses has a serious effect. At the very least, it might be persuading many of us to keep our salary as high as possible by knocking ourselves out by working all these hours.
Yeah, and part of what I often think is a little misleading about just the notion of keeping up with the Joneses is that it seems really frivolous. It seems like it's all about just having a bigger car or having nicer clothes. But I think it's actually more than that. So what happens when you have the consumption patterns being set at the top is that prices are going to go up for everybody. I mean, you can see that in housing prices and in very rich cities like San Francisco. People get pushed out of that city.
Let's just think about wanting the best for our children. That often means good schools. And if you want a good public school, that means perhaps a better neighborhood. And the houses in that better neighborhood might be more expensive. And so you got to work the longer hours just to be sure that your kids have a decent future.
Right. It kind of shows up anywhere where the goods are so limited, like there's only so many houses in that nice neighborhood where the public schools are of high quality, that one has to compete in order to get in there.
Homa Zarghami is an economics professor at Barnard College. She advises the group that puts together this open source textbook. Homa, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Something else causing all the hours, the power of bosses versus workers. That's in our podcast if you miss it on the air. Econ Extra Credit, marketplace.org. And we are from APM, American Public Media.